Hi, this is Jenny Chamberlain, and welcome to my Southern Utah Housing Podcast. This season, we're talking about attainable housing.
Today, I'm really excited to have Jeff Madsen here on the podcast. He's a local builder. He works primarily in the Hurricane Valley. Jeff,
yeah, is that right? Well, Washington County, but primarily Hurricane Valley.
Okay, cool. So, Jeff, why don't you start out by telling us a little bit about yourself and, you know, what kind of business you focus on, maybe if there's anything you specialize in, that sort of thing.
Sure. Well, my background is actually in accounting.
Really?
Yeah. So I got my degree in accounting and started working for an accounting firm and realized that wasn't the life for me. I mean, I enjoyed it for a year and that was about it. I don't know how I could have done it. So I moved back down to my hometown, St. George, and ended up getting a job for a civil engineering contractor doing back office accounting. And there realized the opportunity, and not just the opportunity, but like I really enjoyed creating and building and seeing the fruits of my labor in more than just a balanced financial statement. Mm-hmm. And so I got into vertical construction inside that business, and found that I loved it, and started to push towards development and developing the land that that this family owned, and then building homes on top of it. And we did several commercial projects, and in those commercial buildings, a lot of work for the government. I learned quite a bit about really the methods of construction and the processes that was needed. Started going into homes, realized that's super fun, and enjoyed that so much that the accounting thing started taking the back seat, and I focused more of my time in development and home building.
So did you have to go back to school and get a contractor license, or is that something you can just study on your own and take a test? And
yeah, you need to get a contractor's license in Utah. It's changed over the years, but at the time I needed so many years of experience, and then had to take a couple tests, and then that's how I got my license.
Cool. Yeah. Cool. So I've been thinking it would be fun to start asking people to describe the first house they lived in, maybe when you're young, because a lot of people, I think, have unrealistic expectations about what their first house will look like.
So when you ask that, I initially think of my very first house as a kid. And then I think of the first house as
a young adult, as a
married person.
Yeah.
Maybe that's. And so my first house as a kid, it was huge in my mind. And then when I went back 15 years later, I'm thinking, oh my gosh, where these stairs are only 4 feet wide. And I thought they were the biggest, longest stairs that we would slide down and play games on. And we had a little fire pit off of the entryway that was like an actual pit inside the office. And I remember we did everything in that little fire pit, but it really was like a 4-foot by 5-foot area but we somehow fit. I have 8 siblings, and I remember playing Atari on that little fire pit like it was every day, all day. That was the thing. And then I think about my house when I first got married. We actually lived in this old, one of the pioneer homes of St. George. It was, it had many owners, and when we lived in it, it was the first people that have lived in it since the last 3 years previous. And many things went down there. You know, it was like kind of a drug house and a transient house. And so nobody knew we lived it. We fixed up one little corner of it and lived in it for a year. And then that's when I started getting into more of this construction. And then we restored the whole thing. And now it's known as the Thompson Mansion. And it's right across the street in downtown St. George from the Brigham Young Winter Home.
Oh, nice.
And so my wife and I lived there for a year, loved it. It was full of stories. I mean, every day was a new story. It was either ghosts or transients. We didn't know which one.
Did people come tell you? Did other people tell you the stories, or you just learned?
Oh, no, we had stories. We would wake up and our stuff would be in different places, and we don't know, and we think that we just, either, like I said, ghosts or transients. It's somebody coming in and shouldn't have been in there because we only lived in one section of it. Like it was a big house, and we lived in the top corner. And yeah, it was fun. I mean, it was fun for a year, and then after that, it was just enjoyable. It was another year of my life just taking it apart and putting it back together, and doing it in the manner that was like consistent with the
newer building codes and
not the newer building codes, more
the historical integrity.
The Historical Preservation Committee. We met with them several times to figure out what they wanted, and we got an architect on board that was
familiar
and specialized in that. And so we went back and tried to. We actually took like 5 layers of flooring up and got it down to original wood floor and restored that. It was awesome because we had like newspaper clippings from, you know, like the 1960s and I'm sorry, the 1860s.
Wow.
And then we actually had, we actually took one wall down and realized there's a whole nother set of cabinets behind it. And that's when I thought we were going to find all this Brigham Young gold, but didn't. Dang it. It was just
that's
cabinets.
That's really fun. Yeah, our first house was built in 1940, and the people who had owned it before us took all the flooring off down to the wood floor.
Uh-huh.
And they shined it up and put a beautiful finish on it. And it was funny because my husband's grandma, when she came over for the first time, she just kind of looked at it a little bit disdainfully at the wood floor, which we loved because we thought it was so pretty, and it's you can't even buy quarters on oak anymore.
Right.
And she was like, aren't you going to put a rug on that? Because in her day, the wood floor was like the old-fashioned kind that it was time to cover it with carpet because that was the new thing that everybody could afford carpet. So
yeah, there was funny how you could see how they took coffee cans and they and they patched the holes with like parts of the coffee can.
Oh,
and,
wow.
Yeah, and then we left those there, and it was cool. It was a fun project.
That is pretty fun. Well, so let's shift gears and talk about the issue that I always want to talk about, which is affordable housing. So what do you think of when you think of the term affordable housing?
I think of what I could afford when I had 3 kids. And at that time in my life, which I was probably 30, maybe not even that old, 30, about 30 years old. Because there's so many people 30, I mean, I just think about newlyweds and haven't started to have families where, you know, they no longer can live in a room, and they've got to move out and have space for their kids, for them. And it doesn't need to be a lot of space, but I think about those people and what they can afford. And it's difficult. It's difficult because, I mean, obviously this day and age we are in Southern Utah. The land has come up so much, and that alone has costs of materials, costs of labor, and everything combined with the interest rates, it's just almost impossible to meet that. And that's the battle that we have here in Southern Utah, is how do we find a fix for that, and how can we make that work?
Yeah, and I think bringing up land is an interesting thought because I remember being in real estate school, and that was 5 years ago, and they in the class they were like, well, what do you think is the most expensive part of building a house? And I was like, I don't know. Is it the lumber? Is it the, you know, fees and stuff to the government? And even back then it was land, but that wasn't the first thing I think of. And now I would be like, obviously it's the land because even just a lot for a house is so expensive here. So
Yeah, and it's expensive, and there's not a lot of them. There's not a lot of good land like there used to be. Like, we've taken it off, we've developed it, and now every time you go to a piece of land, you're like, okay, how do we get this to where it's build ready?
Yeah, and it's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work and money, and there's some challenges there.
Yeah. So we know it's a huge problem in our county, and who do you see as the people who are best equipped to solve the affordable housing problem? Like, who are the team members? Because we know it's a complicated problem, right?
It's a complicated problem, and it definitely is a team effort for sure. I think it starts with the cities. It starts with regulation. It starts with land use. There's also, I mean, it's, we're on a project. We just got a project that we, that these people have owned this lot for 15 years. We went, we got a permit, all approved. They decided to change the plan, so we went back to get a permit. Well, the city, I'm not going to say which city, but the city said, well, you need to get this report now and before we can start. So we looked at what that report was. We got a quote, $7,500 for a report. And they, of course, were like, what in, what's going on? Why do we have to pay this? Not only is it $7,500, but it's another 2 or 3 weeks. And that's going to put us past, they were on a very time crunch. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, the engineer put the report together, and all he did was put a report together, and he said, we can't tell you anything about this because we don't know without doing a full study on the entire river. It was an erosion control report. Oh, and, wow. And it was, he was worried, and they, the city said it's inside, it's not inside FEMA, mm-hmm. which is a floodplain, but it's inside what this hazard control that the city placed on a the river area. On certain areas. Hmm. And then they said, you got to do this report. Well, the engineer did the report $7,500 later. And in that report, it was just like basically saying, hey, I can't tell you anything unless you do a full river report, but here's what I know. Mm-hmm. And he put that together, and the city said, okay, that was good enough. And I'm like, well, that doesn't help you at all from any different from where we were at before. Now
good
we're too
thing we paid all this good, money.
Yeah. Paid that money. And ultimately what happened to that client is because of that 2 to 3 weeks and that they can't build the house anymore. Ugh. They lost the opportunity. So now they're going to have to wait. I mean, it's other issues, but personal issues, but if we had started when we were supposed to start, then it wouldn't have been an issue.
It would have been fine.
It would have been fine. So like things like that, it made it to where it makes it to where you add up these fees and this regulation and these sometimes unneeded reports and liability that is supposed to be shifted from one person to another. And we put so much emphasis and priority in that it just adds up, and it's very difficult for, I mean, $7,500 on a multi-million dollar house isn't that big of a deal. But if you get down to where you're trying to get, you know, $300,000 to $400,000, that's a big deal. Mm-hmm. And you add that a couple times and all
it
of a sudden,
be a deal breaker.
Yeah, they can't afford it anymore.
Yeah, interesting. So what we've already talked about a couple. Can you think of other things that stand in the way of affordable housing?
Yeah, sorry, let me go back to the team members. I mean, I definitely think it's back to overall regulation, mm-hmm. from Washington, D.C. and down. I mean, I think that is a huge, there's so much increase in pricing of materials because they're trying to protect somebody, or they're trying to protect so many different facets of it that all it does is give excuses or reasons, sometimes legitimate, that increase costs. And then that cost has to be passed. They think that it's just affecting the big businesses. No, the big businesses don't care. They just increase the price of whatever they're selling. Mm-hmm. And that price then goes to another, from the manufacturer to the distributor. And the distributor, they increase the price. The distributor gives it to the supplier, and they increase the price. And then our subcontractor gets it. They increase the price to us, and then we have to then increase the price of the house. So it starts way at the top, mm-hmm. and we can't control that. All we can do is we can do the best we can. We have a voice, and we can get together, and we can form coalitions. We can form, we can join in associations that help lobby for it. And I think in Southern Utah, we have the Home Builders Association, which does a really good job, up to the Home Builders Association in Utah and mm-hmm. national. And recently, Southern Utah Home Builders Association started a housing affordability coalition. And there's a lot of resources put into that to help and focus on what we can do there, to talk to government, to talk to the state legislature and national legislature, to talk to our city governments and help fight this problem that we have, that increased costs without added value or without benefit. Mm-hmm. And that's really what I think is the root that we can really have a huge impact on. After that, it's just letting the cities start allowing more freedoms of smart yet higher density.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a scary word to them for a lot of years. I think they're coming around to it, but like higher densities, typically there's myths that if we have too much higher density, it doesn't look good. It increases crime rate. It all these things that it attracts the wrong crowds. I think there's a way to do it. There's concerns there, but
there are ways to manage it and solve it.
Yeah. And I think funny. By not allowing it isn't the right way.
Yeah. And I had a broker explain it to me one time, and he was like, look, if you take 100 residences that are all spread out, or 1,000 or whatever, you're going to have X number of crimes per number of residences, or X number of ambulances for heart attacks or whatever. And if you're in a neighborhood that's spread out, you're not going to see them as much because of the fact that it's spread out. But if you take all 1,000 of them and you put them in a smaller area, then you are going to see them. Mm-hmm. And so it's going to create the perception that there is more, when the reality is there's not, it's not necessarily true.
It's a myth.
You know, it's a myth that is created by virtue of the fact that it is, that they're just closer together proximity wise.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
All of it. I'm not going to exclude the builders. The builders we can, but I think that's where we have to go back. Every time I meet with a subcontractor, especially right now, because it's now not as crazy it has been in the past few years.
Mm-hmm.
But the conversation is something along the lines, listen, we need to figure out how to cut costs. I'm not asking you to decrease your margins to where you can't feed your family. I'm not asking you to decrease your guys' pay.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, let's go back to your suppliers, see what you can do with materials, go back to the drawing board, see how you can become more efficient and help and become more lean in your processes to where we're not wasting. And that's a big one. No waste.
Or upgrading unnecessarily. Like I was talking to another person, and he was like, yeah, I never had granite countertops until I was, you know, last year. And he was in a more mature stage of life. And you see a lot of starter homes and twin homes and things that have granite countertops. Mm-hmm. And we just don't see laminate anymore, but it is way less expensive. And I'm sure there's other things that we could do like that to make the cost
for
lower.
Sure. Yep. That's some good points.
The problem is, by the time you're looking at just countertops, it's like a drop in the bucket of the building costs of the whole project.
It is, so. But I always say, like it's, whenever we talk about budgets and they say, oh, it's only $500, it's fine. I'm like, no, it's $500. It's $500. We got to look at that and say, $500 times 30. Now you're talking $15,000.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we can find those $500.
Over and over.
It adds up. Sense. And I think we are, I see it all the time with people when I'm dealing with clients, and it's very easy for them to say, oh, it's just $500. Oh, that's it. It's $500. And then, or $1,000 or a couple $1,000, depending on who it is. And they're like, oh, it's only $2,000. Like, that's mm-hmm. fine. But they say that on every time. And when we get to the end, it's like, hey, how do we go so far over budget? Well, let's look back.
We said yes too many times.
We said yes a lot of times. Now let's go back and see where we can cut and figure it out that way. I don't know that that's necessarily the answer, but it is a start. I think we got to pull from all these different places, and hopefully at the end of the day, we find that it's meeting some of the needs.
I think it's fun. Like, it's, I can hear your accounting background when you say that. That's kind of fun.
Yeah, that is where I think I'm different. I didn't grow up building stuff. I grew up with Legos and I loved it. And so like, that's kind of like my grow up of background. I built a fort in my backyard once. That was fun.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't have a lot of that growing up. My dad's an accountant. My family's all accountants. And so that's what I was going to do. And I don't know. I didn't.
Yeah, here you are.
Here I am.
Yeah. So what other solutions do you see that can help solve the problems?
So let's talk some of the good things. Like, let's talk about the city of Hurricane. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to say them because I think it was really good what I've seen them do recently, where it's kind of been like a big no, like, how do we stop nightly rentals? Mm-hmm. And I'm going to talk about nightly rentals, not because it allows more affordability. What it does is, what the city of Hurricane did is they now are almost promoting that you can have a hosting license and you can have a nightly rental on your primary residence.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great thing. Like, to me, it meets, there's, we have a lot of tourists coming through Hurricane. We are way undersaturated. We're not there yet. So we have room for us to have more places for these tourists to stay.
Mm-hmm.
And it helps supplement the income for those buying houses.
Mm-hmm.
And in a good way. And yeah. And I don't think there's the, when there's an on-site resident and they're the primary resident and they're managing their nightly rental, I feel like the negatives of the nightly rental go away.
Yeah.
Those things like having partiers or
mm-hmm.
people that aren't being unsupervised.
Yeah.
And when there's the primary resident, they're going to be able to go take care of it right away because they're being affected more than anybody else around them.
Yeah.
And I think when I've seen and I've talked to a lot of people about this, there's not the complaints that you have in a typical unsupervised nightly rental.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, because the city of Hurricane has done that, it is so important that when we build these homes that we include casitas. Like, mm-hmm. it is, to me, almost like you got to have it. Not mm-hmm. because you can't afford it, because you can't afford not to have it. That's what I'm saying. So let's just say nightly rental, you're not doing a nightly rental. At least you have space for when your child gets married, they can go stay there and they can rent it from you long term.
Yeah.
And they have a place to be. So now you're able to afford it. Your child's able to afford it, and you have
two units,
and you kill two birds with one stone.
Yeah.
And if we can do more of that, where it helps supplement the income or mm-hmm. supplement the mortgage payment, subsidize it, I guess, that would be, to me, it's a win-win for everybody.
Yeah.
That's one issue. That's one way to do it.
Yeah. And the research says accessory dwelling units are the best, like one of the best practices too. So.
Yeah. And we're working on a community right now that it is going to strictly have homes with casitas on it,
mm-hmm.
and different types of casitas. Some mm-hmm. bigger, some smaller, some two bedroom, some one bedroom, some studio, and that's going to be the way we look at it all. And go ahead.
And I like it because it seems like in our county that is one of the best solutions, just because we have so much recreational opportunity and we're right next to a national park. We have all those lakes. So even if it's not like right in Laverkan at the mouth of Zion National Park, you still have Sand Hollow, Quail Lake, tons of places to go play in the sand. So
yeah, for sure. Yeah. It's a win-win.
Good. Do you know what other things?
I think that we, kind of back to what you said with, we in Southern Utah have such a high standard of living and our finishes are so nice. That even the lower homes are like granite countertops mm-hmm. and tile showers and everything. Like I think there is a opportunity if to do communities that have maybe that lower standard.
Mm-hmm.
Not, I wouldn't say lower standard, just a more affordable standard.
Yeah.
The problem is the land.
Mm-hmm.
Because the land is so expensive, and if you put those people that can afford a house,
mm-hmm.
it's either you can afford it or you can't, and there's no you're not gonna save that much to where all of a sudden this larger mass percentage of
people can
come now and afford it because you put those in there. But if we can get smaller lots and do that,
mm-hmm.
then I think we can get there. There's just no smaller lots. Right now I'm working on a project in Hilldale, and we're talking about building 400 square foot to 900 square foot homes on entitled lots.
So these are detached?
Detached, and mm-hmm. they're entitled portions of the lot. Mm-hmm. So like you can actually buy, it's not even, it's not even, eight. I think it was not even 8,000 square foot lot.
Oh, that's tiny.
So it's a tiny lot, but it's still it's still enough space. If you put a 20, if you put a 400 square foot footprint on this lot, you still have room for a yard.
Mm-hmm.
And now these kids can afford it. Yeah. And so we think we're going through it right now.
You're doing the math.
Mm-hmm. Doing the math.
Okay.
And I hope that it works out and we can and we can develop and then we were going to entitle. They're already entitled, and now we just need to develop them and
build so when homes. You say entitled, does that mean they will each own their individual lot, or is it? Because I feel like a lot of times when I see stuff like that, it's you buy the house itself, but the lot is still owned by some association, and you're just paying rent every month. Is it different from that?
It's different. It's actually slab on grade, and it's going to be to where each lot will have its own parcel ID number.
Okay, cool.
Mm-hmm.
And Hilldale's kind of out there, so I don't know if it'll help the Hurricane Valley affordability, but I guess if you worked in Hurricane, that's not too far to drive.
It's kind of out there, but I think it will. That kind of a project is more what I'm thinking. Like if we can find more options to do that kind of a project, I think it is. It's sustainable.
Yeah,
it helps.
Yeah, it'd be good. So I was going to say, what projects are you working on or talking about that'll improve affordability? But I think you.
Yeah, I have some townhomes. Problem is, even the townhomes are hard. Like we get.
Yeah.
We're every day for me is like, all right, how can we reduce our costs in these townhomes? And they're 1760 square foot townhomes, and they're right in Hurricane, and they're just still to me. Difficult for most of them that we've sold have been to investors.
That's what I keep seeing, and the rent is way less expensive than if they were to get a mortgage, like a first time mortgage on them. The rent's less expensive, which is kind of a flip because when my husband and I got married and we bought a little tiny old house, it was cheaper to have a mortgage back then.
Yeah,
but that was before the first bubble and then
recession. So that's where you're right is. It doesn't pencil out for them to buy it and have a mortgage.
Yeah.
And the rent is still high.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, I don't think it's affordable by the standards of, you know,
median income.
Yeah. 33% of your income or whatever it is.
Yeah. For sure. It's not. Well, I think we've talked about most of the things I wanted to talk about. Do you have any other thoughts about affordable housing you want to?
I love that you're talking about it. I think it's super important. And I think that let me just say this. We are getting better at building. And I think with all this crazy that's been happening, we lost track of becoming more lean and more efficient, less waste. With slowing down, I think not just us as general contractors, but also the manufacturers, the factories, the suppliers, the subcontractors, I think in general, everybody is finding ways to become more lean. And they're just not, there was a lot of like, I wouldn't say price gouging, but like increasing the price because they could.
To meet demand. Yeah.
And it was just supply and demand issues. Yep, supply and demand. And that was the only way to curb that demand is just to increase price. And we're getting that back down, that taken care of.
To where we have to compete, which is nice.
Yes. And I've seen in my, I mean, every day I get multiple phone calls from subcontractors for a good year and a half, I didn't have any. And now it's more than one a day. And so that means that there's people that are hungry for work again. And I hope that we find the work for them. I hope that we are, but it's more intelligent the way that we do it. It's smarter. And that we do it in a way that's not, that doesn't hurt or damage anybody's ecosystem of how they live and the ecosystem of the building process in and of itself. And we are able to become, and when we come out of it, it's a more affordable house for everybody.
Yeah. We should get the word out to the general public because for a while there, if you needed something fixed in your house, you just couldn't get anyone to come.
Oh yeah. Yeah. There so was, they definitely,
it's a good time to get help, I guess.
We're picky about what work they took on and we all were, and it was, and it was just because you could, you wanted to.
You could be.
Yeah, you could be. And you hate to say things you can't do. You hate to promise something that you can't
can't back deliver.
Yeah.
I did have one other question while you mentioned earlier. So is it Southern Utah Home Builder Association? Do they have their own internal housing action group?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because the county has one.
Oh, yeah, I think it's part of the counties. I'm sorry.
At our last meeting, they were saying that they weren't going to come to our meetings as often because they were going to focus on their own thing. So I didn't know if they had decided to do it just internally with the
Suba?
Home builders. Yeah.
I think that it is. I thought they came. They do have their own thing, but I thought they joined the county one as well.
They had for a while, but I think they were like, we're going to spend our time more efficiently or effectively doing what we...
Maybe so.
I'm fine. Like, I think we should all independently be working and then maybe occasionally get together and try to coordinate. But I was just curious.
Yeah, I was... I used to be more involved in it. Mm-hmm. When I was on the board of SUBA, but I'm not no longer on the board. Okay. So I just hear and try and piece it together.
Cool.
I do know there's a lot of talk about it, though.
Uh-huh.
We go to our monthly luncheons and... Yeah, it is at least one a year that we devote just to
affordability.
Yeah,
that's cool.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. All right. Well, I think that's all the questions I have.
Cool.
Thanks so much, Jeff.
Yeah, thank
you. Appreciate you coming.
Thank you for listening to the Southern Utah Real Estate Podcast with Jenny Chamberlain. I hope you'll think about subscribing and give the podcast a review if you found it valuable. If you have feedback or ideas to make this podcast better, check out my website, jennychamberlain.com, and leave me a message there.